Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Today, our guest is nobody. Rich and I are going to be talking about how we got started gambling, actually playing games before we were gambling, and eventually into being successful gamblers. And later on, we'll talk a little bit how Richard is teaching his own son, who's in his early 20s, a bit about gambling.
Yeah, I often get asked, you know, how did you start, and which I'm sure you do too.
Uh-huh.
And then I also often get asked, like, what can I do? You know, what should I do if I want to get involved and all that? So yeah, I think we'll answer some of those questions and go from there.
And everybody's path is different. So you can't walk the same path that somebody else did 30 years ago because the world is a whole lot different. And you're either smarter than I am or dumber than I am, better at talking to people or worse than talking to people, better at math or worse at math, or blah,
well,
blah,
but,
blah.
But not better looking.
Oh, it couldn't be that.
I was talking about myself, actually.
Ah. So this will give you an idea how we got started. I'm real close to 70 years old now. When I was a boy, I was pretty sickly. Had pneumonia a number of times, had asthma. Stayed home from school a lot. Read a lot. Jigsaw puzzles, crossword puzzles. I read books on how to play chess. All kinds of things to keep my mind active. I played with my younger brothers and sisters. I would kick their ass, although I was 2.5 years older. And, of course, if I was 10 and he was 7, that was kind of an inherent advantage. My father was never a great chess player or a poker player, but he had played in the Army, I was born in 47 and he got out of the Army in 45. So when I was 10, it had been 12 years earlier that he had played. And he was decent. He's smart. And so just playing with this smart adult gave me insights that I wouldn't get playing with my peers.
You know, I grew up in Chicago, and the winter is insane. And when it's below zero, people back there play games. They play cards. They play board games. They just, because they don't want to go out in the ridiculous cold and the snow, it was just a lot more popular. So I think if you're exposed to a lot of games young and enjoy them, you know, it's a kind of a natural progression.
Yeah, that's an advantage I didn't have. I lived in Los Angeles, and in January it was, you know, cold, which is 55 degrees, but you could still go outside and play and throw a football around and stuff like that.
You were
that.
Sick instead of cold.
So I didn't have the advantage of living in miserable weather. All the competition I could find, I would take up, whether it was playing chess with other people, being on a chess team or a debate team or a checker club at one school, always trying to compete against others, generally better than my peers, although it wasn't a high level of peers. I went to public schools. We lived in a part of the Los Angeles City school system, which was on the border between, well, at the time was called Watts, which is an area of where there were riots in 64, and it was basically the worst part of town, Gardena, which was becoming more Japanese, and they highly valued education. And so it was like our schools were like a third white, a third Asian, and a third black. And the classes.
Do you remember when you first made a bet? I mean, you were competing at these games, but do you remember when you actually bet something?
I don't remember the specific incident, but I would have been 10 or 12, somewhere in that range. There, my next-door neighbor was Denny Shoemaker, and he was a sucker for all my bets. He could throw a baseball further than I could, and his dad would take us to baseball games, and they put up with me. But when it came to cards or checkers or chess or something, he was a sucker.
So you just one day decided to say, let's play for money? And he was amenable?
Sort of. I don't know who talked me into it, but I had... when I would go to the library to check out books on how to play games, there were poker books in there, in that section. And so I was reading how to play poker books when I was 8 or 9 or 10. And so I knew about gambling of sorts, but so it was not a real stretch.
I mean, I was always really, you know, competitive too, playing games, and learned, you know, games very young. My grandmother taught me how to play gin rummy when I was 3. But I remember I have an older brother, 2 years older, and when he was in high school, I don't think I was in high school yet, but he invited a bunch of friends over to play poker. And I had always watched my dad and my grandfather play poker. But so this was the first time they, you know, included me. I could play, and we were literally playing for nickels and dimes.
Uh-huh.
And but that was the first time that I played poker for money, and I ended up winning, you know, $5.20 or something like that. And to me, it was like the heavens opened. I mean, I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing in the world. You can actually make money playing cards. What could be better than that?
Yeah, one time off the air, you told me that you made money because your grandfather made money playing cards. What was that all about?
Well, yeah, my grandfather, you know, he played poker and gin rummy and pinochle, and he was always a winning player. He would keep track of his wins and losses, and at the end of his games, he would throw the change into this cigar box. Well, all the money would go in the cigar box or come out if he lost, and then after New Year's, he would take all of the coins and put them in pickle jars and divide them among all the grandkids. But I used to love watching him play poker. And my dad would play with him. And my dad was a terrible poker player, but my grandfather was a good one. And so, you know, I remember being 6 years old, sitting behind them, watching them play. And the highlight of the night for me was when one of them had to go to the bathroom and I would get to play their hand. And you know, mostly I was the waitress. All of the guys drank scotch, so I would go to the, you know, bar to get them their scotches. And, of course, I'd fill them too full and have to sip it down. And that's where I learned to play poker and drink scotch. So, but, yeah, so my grandfather definitely was a big influence in the in gambling, because I saw that it was possible to actually win consistently.
So your granddad was good and your dad was bad. So would you sit behind your grandfather to learn, or sit behind your father to learn what not to do, or?
No, I sat behind my grandfather. Yeah, I wanted to watch him because I knew he was good, you know.
Could you pick up much from watching what he did?
You know, I was 6 or 7. I guess I must have picked up something. I mean, he basically played really tight. So I did notice that he was folding a lot and my dad was playing a lot.
Was this draw poker?
Yeah. They played 5-card draw. Yep.
So if you got a sense as to how often he kept kickers.
Yeah, and always once a night he would... usually it would involve, he would have a pair of deuces, and he would raise and stand pat and bet and raise and play the hand as if he had, you know, a full house. Or something.
Uh-huh.
And he would always show it. I mean, he would almost never get called because everybody knew he was a tight player, and he would always show the hand, and I got it. I got... even at that young age, that he was advertising, that he wanted them to know that sometimes he was going to bluff. And so, yeah, I learned some lessons from him. But it wasn't, I didn't read any books on poker until after that night where I played myself and won money, and then I did the same thing as you. I went to the library and got whatever books they had on poker, which there were not many at that time. Maverick's Book of Poker was one of them. Education of a Poker Player by Yardley was one I really enjoyed.
I did too, but that one talks about his experiences in the Second World War or something, and hard to relate to when he was playing.
Well, but, you know, I liked the blackjack books that were along that line, too. That was one of the reasons I liked Ken Houston's blackjack books, was because he had stories about playing, and Yardley had stories about playing poker in China during World War II, where he was a spy. I mean, you know, he had a pretty cool life.
And he lived to tell about it, which one of the reasons it made it cool. In that time period, I also started to read about blackjack, and Revere's book. Do you remember the name of it? I don't.
Playing Blackjack is a Business.
Playing Blackjack is a Business.
That was my first blackjack book. Yeah.
Had all these charts in it. So I went through that, and I learned it pretty well. The part in there that was the most influential to me was he was talking about all these good games in Vegas, that there was a single deck blackjack game at Caesar's Palace, and you could, it was strip rules, which at the time was a even money game, and they would give you, they would comp you in suites and fly you there and pick up your room charges, and all these things were promised, and it would really be impressive to the ladies you could bring there. Now, I was this high school kid at the time, hadn't kissed my first girl yet. This sounded wonderful. I was willing to play an even game if I could get laid. This was pretty good. So
that sounds like a good trade-off. But how did you find the book? I mean, did somebody tell you about it, or you just happened across it?
I would just always check the gaming section in the library. And so this was a Los Angeles public library system, and we had a two or three branches close to us, and there was a city system and the county system, and they were different, but they had selections, and so I would always check out, and one day that book appeared and checked it out.
See, in my case, I had taken up backgammon, and I did the same thing. I went to the library, got all the backgammon books I could, and at that time, backgammon really was popular, and a lot of local bars would hold weekly tournaments. And I would go to a lot of those weekly tournaments.
This would have been early 70s, maybe?
Yeah, very early 70s. And so I was at these backgammon tournaments all the time, and I met a dentist who was a regular player, and he told me he had just come back from Las Vegas, and you know, he had a system for winning at blackjack. I was like, oh yeah, right. You know, how many of those stories? And you have one at roulette too, right? But he said, no, he said, this is real. You know, you can beat the game of blackjack by keeping track of the cards. And he started to describe the mathematics of it. And I started to think, oh, this sounds plausible, right? Maybe this guy isn't an idiot. And I asked him, you know, if there was a book, and he said, Revere's book, Playing Blackjack is a Business. And I had to special order it. I went to the bookstore and had to special order it, and eventually it came. And, yeah, that was how I learned about blackjack and really sort of changed the trajectory of my life. Because once I read that book, you know, by this time I was in college, and I was making my way through college playing backgammon and poker. And once I read that book, I thought, well, once I turn 21, I'll just, my degree was in theater, and my plan was to go to L.A. and become a famous movie star, of course.
How did that work out?
Great. But I was unwilling to go there and be a dishwasher at night to be a starving actor. So my plan was, well, I'll just go to Las Vegas and, you know, make a fortune with this card counting, and play backgammon at the same time and poker and, you know, just be a professional gambler until I have enough money to go to L.A. and be an actor and not have to wash dishes at night. So that pretty much, you know, that ended, is what ended up happening. I ended up, I read playing blackjack as a business. I would practice in my basement. I learned basic strategy, you know, down cold. And for my 21st birthday, my gift to myself was one of those, you know, 4 days and three nights in fabulous Las Vegas that includes the airfare and the whole bit. And
is this Vegas World?
No. Vegas World didn't exist yet. There was a little dump on the strip next to the Flamingo. It wasn't the Flamingo. It was called the Flamingo Capri. And
don't remember that.
Yeah, well, I didn't know any better, so I booked this thing. And when we got here, it turned out that they had overbooked. This casino had one table and some slots. And they had overbooked, and they ended up putting me out at the Showboat, which was on Boulder Highway.
That's a long way away.
That is a long way away. And I complained, and I rented a car, and they picked up the rental car for me. So it turned out to be a better deal. It was a nicer hotel, and I got a rental car so I could go all over and explore everywhere. And I was only playing basic strategy, but I won about $200 on that trip. And I thought, oh, you know, if I can win like this, just knowing basic strategy, just think how much money I can win if I know how to count.
That's right. Easy to extrapolate.
Right. So, yeah, then as soon as I graduated college, I basically packed up the car and moved out here.
All right. So now Richard mentioned he went to L.A., which was eventually when I met him in the late 70s. I want to, before we get to that and us meeting each other, I want to go back a little bit to when I started backgammon. I first learned about backgammon in the early 70s. I think it was in a Playboy magazine, which I only read for the articles. That's why I had the Playboy magazine.
Well, Playboy was a big promoter of backgammon.
Yes,
and
they
I
were.
Actually went and played a tournament that was sponsored by Playboy. They had a big party at the Playboy Mansion in Chicago. And yeah, I played against Christy Hefner in the tournament.
Yes. Not a bad way to play a tournament. I got to play against Lucille Ball in just before she died, so that was not quite the same experience at all. But actually, that was pretty cool. So I started picking up. I went and bought all the backgammon books I could find. There weren't many of them, and the ones that were there weren't very good. There was a Oswald Jacoby and somebody, John Crawford, had a book.
Obolensky, Prince Obolensky.
Saw that one. I was at the Alpha System.
No, I don't think that wasn't the name of it. But.
So Tim Holland had a book. And so these, but I mastered what they had in it. And so I had been working in a think tank in Santa Monica, which is near the beach, and didn't do well there because they didn't really check your hours, and you can spend as much time at the beach as you wanted to, and I spent too much time at the beach and not enough time in the office, and so I underperformed, and so after a couple of years, they let me go. But then by that time, I thought I was pretty good at backgammon. So I heard about this club in West Hollywood. It was called the Cavendish West. The Cavendish was a club in Manhattan in New York.
And I also, there was a Cavendish in Chicago, and okay. I spent all of my days at the Cavendish in Chicago.
So I started going there, and I had some money saved up, was collecting unemployment, and winning at the Cavendish, because early on I was a better player than most of the others there because they had not read as much as I had. And later there was a book by Paul McGreal called Backgammon, which was a huge eye-opener at the Cavendish. We were not playing anything like what he suggested. And then when the book came out, I got a copy right away. I just started creaming the other players because I was slotting checkers, which means basically taking chances other people wouldn't take, and started to do well. Eventually, how the better players played was picked up by all the others, and so I no longer had an edge. But my skill at backgammon came from reading. It came from playing what we call propositions, where you set up a position, and there's an infinite number of positions, and you say, well, I think the red checkers have the advantage over the white checkers. And somebody will say, no, I think you're wrong. And so let's play. And so we agree to play for 20 games or 50 games or however much they were. Some propositions take only a few rolls to figure out. Some can take a long time. And so I would try to remember these positions. And so I learned, but I was not one of the best players. After a while, I could only beat the second tier players, could not beat the top tier players. And there's a lot of top tier players who hung out at the Cavendish. And so eventually, as it turned out, I went broken, had to go out and get a job, which was awful. Oh, God, that was terrible.
God forbid.
Which was actually a great lesson. I only went broke once, and I never want to go out and have to get a job again. But when Richard came along, probably 78, I first met him. Do you remember when you first went to Cavendish?
It would have been, yeah, something like that, late 70s. I hadn't moved to L.A. I was living here in Las Vegas, still playing a lot of backgammon here. And some of us knew there was going to be a tournament in L.A., so we drove in and went to the Cavendish for the tournament.
So I was under the impression that I'd been to a few tournaments, and I thought I was pretty good. So anybody I didn't recognize, ipso facto, I had to be a better player than them. So Richard came along. Would you like to play? Sure, come on, sit down. Now, I never figured out that he was a better player than me. I probably played, I don't know, 90% as good as him, 95%, I don't know. But he was better. But in backgammon, every particular game, there's luck involved. You know, if you had only rolled this instead of that, the whole thing would have been different. And so any session where he beat me, it was clearly because he got lucky.
Well, that's what makes it such a great gambling game.
So any sessions I beat him, well, that's justice. I mean, of course I'm going to beat him. I'm a better player. And the fact that he beat me more than I beat him over time was just, he's a lucky son of a bitch. I don't know. So I never figured out he was better than me. Some of the other players I played long enough that I got to, all right, there's no real doubt here. But with Richard, he wasn't there enough for me to really come to that conclusion. And
that for me was actually my strength in the game, is I was always underestimated. People just never, there was something about me, I just look harmless or stupid or something, and people just never gave me credit for being able to play. And there was a guy in Chicago who he gave me what we called the slow boat proposition. He kept telling me that he wanted to get me on a slow boat to China, you know. And this was a player that I was clearly better than. And so he came up with the following proposition that we would go to Las Vegas. People were talking about making a trip to Las Vegas at that time. And he said, I will pay for your airfare if the entire time we're on the plane, you have to play backgammon with me for $50 a point. And I was, please don't throw me in that briar patch, right?
Now, and did you have the bankroll for this, or it would be easy to get backers?
Yeah, well, yeah. yeah, I had the bankroll for it, but one of the players who was one of the only players in Chicago better than I am, or was, told him, you're out of your mind. Like, you're not a better player than Munchkin is. You know, you're crazy to offer him this proposition. So it never happened. But as I was saying, that was my strength. There were guys who would play backgammon with me that would not play against other players. And I remember a friend of mine got so steamed one time because I had come to the club and I sat down and I was playing with this old bookmaker who was this really nice guy, couldn't play at all. I mean, he was at best a low intermediate player. And he would never play with any of the good players. And I sat down and we started playing. And my friend came in and he sees me playing this guy and he goes, can we make this a chouette? And the guy says, no, we're just playing heads up. And they had a rule that any chouette was open. If you had a chouette is backgammon for more than two people. And if you had a chouette going, anybody who wanted to join could. But if you're playing heads up, you don't have to make it a chouette. So Freddie says, no, we're just going to play heads up. And he leans across the table to me and he goes, we don't want those hustlers in our game.
You agreed, of course.
Of course I agreed, yeah, yeah. So, and I have to tell you another story about my persona or the way people perceive me. So when I came to Las Vegas, I got a job as a dealer because I didn't have the bankroll to play blackjack right away for big stakes, and I thought that'd be the perfect place to practice counting cards by dealing it 8 hours a day. Anyway, I was dealing, and this guy was a really sort of happy, boisterous guy, you know, kind of life of the party type. And he's on my table and we're talking and we're having a good time. And basically it turns out this guy is a golf hustler. And he only had one leg. And I guess that was part of his shtick, right? Like, he apparently was a really good golfer, but he had a prosthetic leg. And he says to me, you know, let's go out and play. I'll give you a stroke a hole. And I said, you don't know me from Adam. A stroke a hole is an enormous spot. How can you offer me that? And he said, I can just look at you and tell that you can't play. And then he said, in fact, I'll take off my leg and use that as the club. Which I don't think he was serious about that, but who knows? Maybe he had played that kind of proposition. But anyway, yeah, that was the sort of what I projected to people was that I must not be able to play at whatever the game was.
I did not project that. Perhaps it was my vocabulary. Perhaps I was wearing glasses and looked like a smart kid, which was really to my detriment. So people generally overestimated me. It's actually, they still do. They think Bob Dancer never makes a mistake at video poker, which is a level I could never live up to. But okay, so before we move on from our backgammon days, there was another character at the Cavendish who hung out there. His name is Gabby Horowitz. Gabby Horowitz was I think he was Israeli. He was a street urchin, kind of a cheat. He had very fast hands. He could distract you and make checkers disappear. And he was a competent player, not great, but his sleight of hand tricks could even up the match.
He was good at PR too. I mean, he had a column in a syndicated backgammon column in newspapers across the country.
Yes. Although he had a co-writer, Dr. Bruce Roman, who cleaned up Gabby's English a little bit.
Yeah.
But so I actually took classes from Gabby, which was interesting. So later on, we would play backgammon if Gabby rolled like a 6 and a 4, which all the math majors out there knows that adds up with 10. And I had a loose checker 11 spaces away, he would just take his checker and put it on mine and put mine on the bar, meaning he hit me.
Ten, snap up his dice.
You know, and I'd just look at him and I say, nice play. And he'd put it back.
Oh, well, because a lot of people, he would just snap up his dice and you would go, you had a 6-4. And he'd say, no, I didn't. I had a 6-5. It was 11. You know, and now you can sit there and argue about it for however you want to argue. But
well, when I would play him in tournaments, I would insist on there being a spotter, insist on there being a witness.
Yeah.
Another one who really influenced my backgammon career was not much of a player, but he's a theoretician. His name was Danny Kleinman, and he wrote thousands of pages on how he thought the right way to play backgammon was. Now, later on, it appears as though some of his theories were not the same as the ones coming out of New York, where in New York you had a lot of really smart players talking to each other and working things out together. And in Los Angeles, Danny was pretty much on his own. And
yeah.
So some of his theories were discredited perhaps later on, but he was a big influence in my life. Him.
You know, that brings up a really important point. Both of us, when we wanted to learn how to do something, went to the library and read everything we could find on the subject. But the other thing that's really important is to get around players that are better than you, that already know how to do what it is you're trying to learn, and learn from them. And I think that the players in New York had a big advantage because there were so many good players there, and they were all kind of sharing information and learning from each other and advancing the game. And it's easier to learn if you have access to, you know, to good players.
Some of those players are still out there gambling in various ways. There was Paul McGreal. There was Jason Lester. There was Mike Sankiewicz.
Billy Horan, yeah.
And Dennis Waterman spent some time there. So we didn't have that in Los Angeles. Another part was most of my skill came from reading, not from figuring it out myself. The better players, many of them, would write computer programs on and say, and let the computer figure out which was better than another. Now, in bear-offs, which is the unending part of backgammon, that's can be an exact science if you have a computer program.
And computers were not accessible back then. People didn't have their own home computers.
So even though I had been a COBOL computer programmer previously, I didn't know how to program the PCs that were there, the Commodores or whatever else they were. And so I couldn't figure it out by myself. The better players had better tools and or perhaps were smarter.
Well, and they were more obsessive, I think, because they would roll positions out hundreds of times by hand just to, you know, get a better understanding of positions. So you can imagine, you know, if you were a hold'em player before computers and you would have to just, you know, deal hands by hand over and over again to look at, to try to determine things. It was a different era.
And I'm not sure whether hold'em is easier or harder than backgammon. They're different. I mean, backgammon is a complete information game, but there's a whole lot of different positions.
Yeah.
Hold'em is an incomplete information game, but there's not that many different combinations. So I don't know which is harder. The another problem I had is Los Angeles has a lot of distractions. For me, one of the distractions was nude beaches. I was born in 47, so like 73 when I started, I would have been 26. And Venice Beach in the Los Angeles area was nude for about a year and a half before they got it closed down. And then they moved up to Topanga for a summer, and then they moved up to Zuma for a while. And I enjoyed this. At that time of my life, although I really wanted to become a better backgammon player, the real object of my life was to get laid. And any women who came to nude beaches were not particularly shy. And so, and there was adult beverages there. There was adult tobacco, shall we say, there. And so sometimes I would enjoy the day rather than use it studying, which was not a good use of my time. Well, not a good long-term use of my time. It sure was a fun use of my time.
You know, I want to bring up you mentioned Tim Holland earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned an important lesson back then that being the best player didn't mean you were going to make the most money. So Tim Holland was a guy who made probably more money playing backgammon than all of... He was a horrible player. But he made more money than anybody else because he was in the right social scene. He could play against very wealthy people, and he had the bankroll to do that. And it made me realize that there's this whole other level that you can try to aspire to. Another guy who became kind of a master of that is Mike Svobodny.
Yes.
Who he could just get games with people that other people would never be able to play against. And it came up in blackjack, even if you look at the case of Don Johnson, right? He is not the greatest blackjack player in the world, but if you have a big enough bankroll, you can kind of jump to a whole new level that the young smart guys just don't have a chance to do, you know, without a whole different way of thinking about the game. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I do, and when Don was on our show, he indicated that maybe there was somebody with a baseball hat standing nearby who would give him signals.
Well, yeah, but if you're, you know, if you're that level of player, you can hire it, or you know what I mean? So, yeah, Tim Holland, I'm sure, could go get lessons from the best players if he wanted, but the point was he could still get the games that the rest of us couldn't get.
Yeah, so like Svobodny is in your book, is in Gambling Wizards, and Svobodny would play with these great people. He was better than them, but when they would beat him, he would be really pleasant, congratulate them, and be happy for them, and he'd be invited back.
Right, and he wasn't a nit, you know? I mean, he would pay for dinner. He would, you know, he wasn't trying to squeeze every dollar out of the situation, and he would take the wrong side of a proposition, just knowing that he had the worst of it, just to sort of show the people that he had some gamble, you know.
And other players, if they lost to an inferior player, they would, the backgammon equivalent of Phil Hellmuth.
Yeah. That's really the reason I gave up the game. There were just too many assholes. And a lot of the worst assholes were the guys, if you really wanted to make money, those were the guys you had to play against. And it just became really sort of distasteful to me.
Well, yeah, that was one of the reasons I gave up. Another reason was the Cavendish had trouble staying afloat. It changed owners a number of times and eventually just stopped. And
eventually the game fell out of favor too.
It did. There was not new blood coming in. So the only players you could play against were the pros trying to hustle you or trying to beat you. And even if Richard and I were equal players, when we go to the Cavendish, they would charge, you know, $10 to play 4 hours, or however much they charge would be dependent on what stakes we were playing. So even if we were equal, the house would eat us up.
Yeah.
And, of course, we weren't equal. But near the end, so it was in the early 80s, for 3 or 4 years in a row, there became million-dollar backgammon tournaments in Las Vegas. And this was a pretty attractive. So I think it was the $500 or $1,000 entry fee, and the winner got $1 million guaranteed. Although if you knew the guy making the guarantee, he was not that great. So a lot of us decided, well, we're going to go to Vegas. And so that's when I started, well, if I'm going to be in Vegas, I might as well beat him at blackjack too. So I was practicing all that at the time. And so my first trip to Vegas was maybe 80, 81, something like that. And staying at the Dunes, which is now where Bellagio is. And did okay a couple times. Beat the head of the owner of the Cavendish in the tournament, and so he kicked me out of the Cavendish because I beat him here. That was an interesting. No, I've hinted at it. Might as well tell the story. The owner at the time was an excellent gambler named Hugh Sconyers. Richard knows him.
He was probably the best player in Los Angeles at the time, too.
He was good. He was somebody like who graduated MIT for 3 weeks of study or something. I mean, he's just incredibly bright guy. And so we were playing in the tournament, and my dice were luckier than his dice. On the sessions we had gone so far. So he called for a dice change. Now, a way dice change works in backgammon is if a player thinks the other guy's dice are luckier, he can demand once per game that they put all four dice into one of the cups, shake it, and then they each take
turns picking one.
They each take turns picking one. And the guy who asked for the dice change, picks second, and then he's ended up with the fourth one. So he calls for dice change, so I poured my two dice out on the table. He picked it up, put it in his cup, and shook it, and we picked. And then on the very next hand, I said, I want dice change. And he goes, you can't have a dice change. I just had a dice change. I go, I think it's hokey, but if you can have a dice change, I can too. So he got upset by that because I somehow had unchanged his dice. And it was just a bad reaction to him losing to an obviously inferior player. So he kicked me out of the Cavendish.
Wow, that's really surprising to me that alone would be enough to have him not want you in the club. I mean...
Well, it's, but in a couple of days, I went in, apologized, said sorry, and everything was fine, and so I was in full standing again. But,
oh, okay.
So it wasn't a permanent ban, but it was, so in a backgammon tournament, skill, the winners have an edge, or good players have an edge, but there's still a considerable amount of luck, and a competent player can beat an excellent player in a 21-point match or something like that.
When I first came here to Las Vegas, you know, in addition to reading the books on backgammon and poker and all that, I just read whatever kind of gambling books I could find, Scarny's Complete Guide to Gambling, and just anything I could find I would read. And one of my favorite books was a book called Fast Company by John Bradshaw. It was actually kind of a inspiration for my book, Gambling Wizards. It was profiles, rather than interviews, it was profiles with six professional gamblers. Minnesota Fats, Puggy Pearson, Amarillo Slim, Bobby Riggs, maybe Doyle Brunson. I don't know. I don't remember exactly who everybody was.
But Bobby Riggs, a tennis player.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he was quite a hustler. But anyway, you know, so I had read these books. Well, when I first came here to Las Vegas, the first night I heard there was a backgammon club, and it was at some discotheque, and so I go, and I come into the club, and here is the guy who runs the club was a guy named Mike Maxiculli, and he is playing backgammon with Puggy Pearson. Now, you know, I mean, to me, I'm 22 years old, and Puggy Pearson is like this guy I've been reading about who's just, you know, it'd be like, you know, seeing Kobe Bryant sitting there or something. And
but you wouldn't expect Kobe Bryant necessarily to be a good gambler. You would expect Puggy Pearson to be good at backgammon.
Yes, no, I mean, you know, for my son is into basketball. For him, it would be Kobe Bryant. I was into gambling. For me, it would have been Puggy or Doyle or Amarillo Slim or somebody like that, you know. And they're playing, and I go over and I stand there, and I'm just kind of watching them play. And Max looks up at me and he goes, do you play? And I said, yeah. And he said, I think they had just finished their game. He says, you want to play some? And I said, sure, although I was really nervous. And he said, you know, what do you want to play for? And I didn't know what to say, you know, so I think I said $5 a point. And, you know, he was probably playing Puggy for 50 or 100 or something. And he kind of cocks his head and he looks at me and he goes, you're not a hustler, are you? And, you know, I'm sure I turned red, you know, because in my mind I was thinking, oh, my God, these guys are just raw meat, you know. And I was very young and naive, but, yeah, it was funny.
Max himself had a few moves.
Well, that came later. Yeah, later Max became a cheat. And, you know, there was an era there in the early to mid-80s where a lot of cheating started happening in backgammon. And, yeah, Max was certainly among them. He cheated me out of $14,000 one night before I realized what, you know, what was going on. But that all came later.
All right. So let's leave the backgammon world for a while. Let's move to blackjack. So for me, my blackjack trip started in early 80s. And would read everything I could and memorize the charts and then go and play. The first one I wanted to learn before I went to Vegas was Revere's Advanced Point Count. This is a three-level system. It's kind of difficult. I didn't have it completely mastered. I had no idea that even a simple one-level system done well is a whole lot better than a three-level system done
poorly.
95% well. And so, but that's what I started with. And big mistake, didn't have any mentors. Had I run into Richard at that time, I mean, I knew him, but I didn't consider him a mentor. You know, and he would have said, you know, learn high, low, or learn high, up, one, or whatever he would have recommended.
Well, you know, when I got here, I started with the high-low, but quickly added the high-op two to play single decks. So at that time, there were still plenty of single decks around Las Vegas. So I would play the high-op two with a side count of aces for single deck, but I would play high-low if I was playing shoe games. And when I started, remember, I was dealing, and I didn't have a big bankroll, and I would go out after, you know, after work and play for nickels and and I would practice while I was dealing. But your talk about having mentors, I don't know if mentor was the right word, but I've often said if I had to play blackjack alone, I wouldn't play. And the having teammates is what happened. That's really what was the difference for me. And I think I've told this story on the air before, but I'll tell it again. I was dealing, and Vegas was a very small town, and all of the card counters really knew each other because there was nowhere else to play. There was no Atlantic City. You could play in Reno or you could play in Vegas and Tahoe, and that was about it. I mean, so everybody knew one another, and a guy, actually, let me digress for a second. People always say to me, oh my God, it must have been blackjack heaven. It was so great back then. It was all the single deck that was even off the top and, you know, four deck shoes with 26 cards cut. And that was all well and good, but it's, to me, it's so much better today because there are so many more places to play. I mean, if you got barred around Las Vegas, unless you were ready to, you know, go to Europe or Asia, you didn't have much place, you didn't have many options. So so to me, that was not blackjack paradise back then. I mean, the shuffles were really great. But anyway, so I was dealing one night, and a guy came into the club. Actually, he's still around, a guy named Will Hale. A lot of the old-timers know Will. But anyway, he came in, and he said, there's a guy in town from Australia, and he wants to play backgammon for a lot of money. So I said, set it up, right? Whatever he wants to play for. And at that time, I thought I played backgammon really well. And I thought there were maybe a dozen guys in the world that were better than me, and none of them were from Australia. So I was happy to set up whatever with this Australian guy. So Will got back to me, and he said, you know, the guy's staying at the Desert Inn on a comp, and, you know, we're all going to be there on Friday, and you know, come on over. And I said, can I bring some friends, you know, who are also players? He said, yeah, maybe we'll have a big chouette. So on Friday, I had two friends who were backgammon players from Chicago that basically came out here when I moved here to visit and never left. And so I took them with me to the Desert Inn. And I get there, and the guy there is a guy named David Lang, who's now dead, unfortunately. But the first thing David says when he opens the door is, I've done some calling around, and I've heard that I'm really outclassed. So I don't want to play for a lot of money. And I said, you know, that's all right. We can play for small stakes. We'll just, and he's like, we can order up lots of room service and we'll just, you know, play small stakes. And there were a couple of other guys in the room, a couple of other blackjack players. And one of those other blackjack players was another Australian guy named Alan Woods, who is one of the guys in my book. So we spent a week ordering up room service and having this, I think it was a $3 chouette or something, so very small stakes. But we were having a great time. And at the end of a week, Alan Woods says to me, how come you guys, meaning me and my two friends, aren't playing blackjack for more money? I said, well, we don't have a bankroll. You know, we don't have a lot of money, so we're just out betting nickels. He goes, well, how about if I put up $20,000 and you guys play for me and you double it and we'll split it 60-40. 60 to him, of course. And I said, you've known us a week, and you're going to give us $20,000 to go gamble with and report back to you how we do? And he reached into his coat, and he pulled out $20,000, and he slid it across the table to me. And that was really how I started playing blackjack for bigger stakes. I mean, and if it hadn't been for that, who knows which, well, where my life would have led. I mean, that was really a defining moment in the future of my life. So I owe Alan Woods a lot. He's dead too, unfortunately.
I'm getting nervous being a friend of Richard. They all seem to die.
Let's have a few words from our sponsors. South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more games than anybody else has like that. The October promotion has casino-wide progressives. The big one starts at $10,000, must be hit by $25,000. In addition to the player hitting it, any player with their card in, when it hits, receives $25 in free play. There is a minor progressive between $1,000 and $2,500. It's expected to hit about three times per day. The progressives combined are expected to give out $600,000 in October. Halloween will have two times points for video poker, quite a few more times points for reels. At videopoker.com, they have four or five new games at the Global Gaming Expo, which is the trade show in town that ended just before this show is going to go on the air. We'll be talking about these shows in a few weeks on this program. They had more new games in video poker than all of the other companies put together. Their game of the week is Split Poker. This is a 6-coin per line game. 10-coin per line game. Periodically, on the deal or on the draw, you get a split card. Split card is randomly any of the 52 cards, let's say 6 of clubs for an example, and randomly, one-third of the time each, that 6 of clubs will split into a 5 of clubs, 6 of clubs, a 6 of clubs, 7 of clubs, or a 6 of clubs, 6 of clubs. So, you get high payouts for a 6-card royal flush, which is ace through 9 of the same suit, and 5 of a kind. All right, let's go back to talking about Alan Woods some more.
Anyway, I was saying that I owed Alan Woods a big debt of gratitude. But the other thing that happened to me was when I was playing for Alan, my two friends and I started playing on that team for Alan. And I lost and lost and lost and lost. And basically, at the end of 160 hours of play, I was stuck big. Oh, now I should also say that at that time, our approach to the game was most of the bosses in Las Vegas thought that shoe games were not beatable. So they were watching the single deck games very closely, and a lot of places had started dealing double decks as well. So we just didn't play those at all. We only played the shoe games. And there were many shoe games that were four decks cut one, sometimes four decks cut half of a deck, six decks cut one, or sometimes less. So we only played shoe games, and we, on that bankroll, we were spreading from a nickel to two hands of 200.
Ooh.
Yeah. So you could spread massively. The penetration was great, and I just could not win. And three or four different times, I had people go out with me and sit at the table with me and watch me play because I was convinced I must be doing something wrong. And every time they said, no, you did everything right. You're just unlucky. So that went on for, I don't know, 2 months or something. And then Alan had to go back to Australia. And at that time, he said, we need to shut down the bankroll, even though it was stuck. And he offered to my friend to play with the team that he was leaving. And I basically said, screw this, you know, this doesn't work. I mean, I thought it worked, but I didn't know what the problem was. And I just was tired of getting my brains beat in every time I went, even though it wasn't my money. And I said, I'm going back to, you know, I was still dealing. So I was also kind of burned out because I was dealing 40 hours a week and trying to go out and play. So I went back to dealing. And, you know, the second sort of major thing happened was my friend who joined Allen's old team, they started winning money like crazy. And after a couple of months, he came to me and he said, you got to give this another chance, you know, because we're just winning like crazy. I mean, they broke a bankroll in like 10 days. They would play and they would double their bankrolls, you know. And the bankrolls were starting out small, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 bankrolls or whatever. But so he said, you got to give this another chance. And thankfully, I listened to him and I said, okay. And I went out and started playing again and then started winning. So I owe him a great debt of gratitude as well. So.
Is this somebody I know, probably?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I do. He became a video poker player when they first introduced video poker to Las Vegas.
My story from that era, I'd actually come to Vegas just knowing basic strategy on a Vegas World trip. Vegas World advertised in whatever magazine, Gambling something.
Gambling Times.
Gambling
Stanley
Times.
Slutikoff,
so. That's it. Who's also gone. Did you know him too?
You know what? I knew the editor, Len Miller, but I didn't know Stanley.
So at Vegas World, this particular promotion is you bring, I don't know, post $3,500 at the cage and bet 4 hours a day at $35 a hand or something. And there's a package of benefits. So that sounded pretty good to me. So I came and I signed up for it and showed up. And it happened the first night I was there, I got pretty lucky. The first thing I did when I sat down was ask for a $500 marker, which they happily brought me. But I never touched it. It just kept growing and growing, just using basic strategy, just getting lucky, which didn't know what was happening, didn't know it was lucky. As far as I was concerned, this was because I was good. The dealer, for some reason, kept telling me about what a nice gourmet room they had there and that I should go and enjoy it, and he was sure he could get me a comp. And I was just going.
The dealer was going to get you a comp.
Yeah, he said, I'm pretty sure I can talk the pit boss into giving you a comp. So I go, well, I already have RFB here because I'm on a program and I'm really enjoying myself, so I'm going to continue playing. So we continued playing, continued winning. And in another half hour, he would tell me again about the gourmet room. And so I wasn't really figuring this out. Eventually, I decided to go. So I paid off my marker at the table. And they strangely gave me back my paid marker and pushed the $500 of chips back at me. So it was like a $500 bonus that I...
Is this a great country or what?
Exactly. I had won, and they had pushed me an extra $500 because they were flustered about something. Couldn't figure it out. So I went to the gourmet room, enjoyed my dinner. The next day, the dealer said, did you read the RJ? You're mentioned in the paper. The RJ is the review journal. And so I was on the front page of the review journal. And this, apparently what had happened was a group of players had approached a dealer and said they wanted him to do some false shuffles and insert a shoe in, and they were going to clean up at Vegas World, and then they were going to split the profits. So he said, yeah, I'll do this. And so then afterwards, he went up to Bob Stupak, who owned it, and he said, this is what's going to go down. What should I do? And so Stupak said, well, let it go down, and we'll have Metro there, and we'll just arrest their asses. And in addition, we'll put it Stupak had a suite on the second floor with cameras on this one table that just happened to be the table that I sat down on. So apparently it was supposed to go off at, they were supposed to show up at 6 o'clock. And I showed up at 5:45 and took my $500 marker and kept playing and playing and playing and winning. And so the next day, Stupak, who kind of held office in the coffee shop there, he said, I was hoping you'd win some more so I could kick your ass out of there and we could just get all this. But I didn't really want to bar you because they would think that was suspicious. And but I just really wanted to get you out of there because there's this Metro hanging around, playing slot machines, waiting for things to happen. There were guns involved. And had a date there to watch this go down, and you were in the way. So
wow, I mean, I obviously I don't condone cheating, but I certainly feel for those guys who were there. You know, I mean, how many times I've been in that situation where we're trying to get on a particular game, and there's some guy on there that we want off. But we would have been much more proactive about trying to get you off the table, both as players, and I'm surprised the casino didn't do something about it to get you off.
Well, they started offering comps to the gourmet room. And
I don't know. Seems to me they could have been more...
It turned out they ended up giving me an extra $500. I think that was an accident, and I think it was because they were nervous about this going down, too.
But why were you on the cover of the paper? What did...
All it mentioned was they took a while because this high roller took this $500 marker. That was who I was. I was a high roller because I had posted $3,500. And so that was my only mention, but I was the high roller who had posted.
So they did bust the guys after you left.
Oh, yeah. Apparently it went down within 5 minutes. Huh. They got there, delivered the shoe. The dealer did a false cut, and I mean, all six positions at the table were taken by the team members, and they let them play two hands and making some, and of course they won all those, and then all of a sudden there was plenty of Metro around.
Wow.
So that could have ended badly.
I'm surprised the players didn't try to get you off. I mean, certainly everyone I know has stories about the things they've done to try to get players off of tables. You know, sort of the most creative, I think, was Tommy Hyland's team. Had something called, I think it was actually called a shit bag, but it was a bag that had, you know...
We can guess.
Soiled diapers, just anything foul and disgusting smelling that you could possibly imagine. And they would go, somebody, whoever was, you know, drew the short straw would be in charge of the bag and would have to carry this bag down to the casino and sit next to the person that they were trying to get rid of.
And open up the bag.
And under the table, open the bag. Yeah. And,
that would be more effective than just mere cigar smoke. And
yeah, certainly many people tried cigar smoke. They tried the, you know, sort of gay cruising of the person, spilling drinks on people. I mean, lots and lots of things to get people off of games. But
none of those things happened to me. So,
well, you were lucky.
So in eventually got... And I specialized when I was playing blackjack in comp hustling or promotion hustling.
Oh, wait, I wanted to ask you about...
Yeah.
You gave up backgammon, and you mentioned that was traumatic for you?
I don't know if it was traumatic. A little bit. I came to the conclusion that I wasn't smart enough.
That can be traumatic.
And that I wasn't good enough. I was used to being... the A student, the smartest kid in the room. And at the Cavendish, I wasn't. I was I was on a second tier. I suppose you could say low-level genius when everybody else was high-level genius or something. I'm not sure it takes genius to play backgammon well, but it took more than I had. Hmm. And realizing that if the directions weren't written down, that I could follow them, I just was out of my league. And the same with blackjack. I was probably got good enough that had I met someone like Richard on a team, I could have convinced them that I was good enough to keep on the team. But I would have not been the leader on the team at that point.
No, but one of the things that I learned there is that effective teams, whether it's blackjack or some other form of gambling, whether you have a sports betting outfit or whatever, there are different people that fill different roles.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're a guy who, obviously, you can learn the strategy and execute it well, which I have no doubt you can, because it's really kind of the same thing in video poker. Well, those people on a team are really important, you know?
Yeah, we call in the big players or whatever you have to do.
Yep.
And so you're betting table minimum and just doing it accurately and doing whatever else is required. And that I could have done perfectly.
Right. And there's some other guy who's going to write the code to analyze the new game, and there's the creative guy who is going to come up with innovative ways to beat games. And you need all those components for a really effective organization, I think. So yeah, you're right. It would have been different, I think, if you had met. And, you know, when people ask me about advice, I tell them one of the first things they need to do is start meeting other players. You know, because it's really, really difficult to just do it on your own. Not just for the moral support, but also if you have this in video poker, if you have a network of people that you know, you share information, and it's really valuable to have. You can't scout the whole world by yourself. So if you have friends that say, hey, there's a promotion in, you know, Kansas City, you know, you wouldn't have found that by yourself.
Yeah, and another thing I didn't realize in blackjack is eventually I got barred at a number of casinos. And I thought what that meant is I can't go back in those casinos and play anymore. And now I, you know, some of the players who've been on this show, they go, oh, yeah, I've been barred from the same casino 18 times.
Oh, yeah. And when we first started playing, one of the good things about playing back then was they didn't have cameras. Or if they had them, they didn't have pictures. They couldn't, you know, print out a photo of who the guy was that they barred. So if we got barred on day shift, we went right back in on swing shift. I mean, they might have had a description, guy in a blue shirt with a mustache or something, but so, yeah, that was one of the good things about back then.
Yeah, and that's a little tip that, you know, a mentor would have shared, and I just didn't have any mentors at the time. We're going to stop today's show. We're going to pick this up in the near future, and at that time, we're going to shift on to a little bit of video poker as to how that happened in the learning curve there, and how Richard got into teaching a little bit to his son today.
All right, Richard, how can people get copies of our show?
Well, first of all, we encourage you to send us your questions, engage with us at gamblingwithanedge.com, or you can send us questions at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or our Facebook page, or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can sign up to get the show delivered to you automatically every week at gamblingwithanedge.com or iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, wherever you normally get your podcasts. And to see an archive of all of the old episodes, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
Very good. Richard, today's been fun. We'll do it again next week's show. And in the meantime, everybody, go out and hit lots of royal flushes. Good day.